Good afternoon, Tamra Davis. Welcome on VH Berries.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I am extremely grateful. How are you doing today?
I'm very good. I'm good. It's the end of my day here in California.
Absolutely, Tamra Davis, and I would love to start by talking about documentaries, because a documentary is equivalent to a mirror held up to nature and reflecting the raw, unfiltered tapestry of existence. And in that light, it is essential to recognize the unmistakable Davis flair, because you are intertwining unfiltered authenticity with the art of storytelling.
That's amazing. Well, thank you. That's a beautiful way to describe documentary filmmaking.
And I would love, Tamra Davis, to start with one of your titles called It's a John Baldessari World. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Sure. I was hired to do it through the Museum of Contemporary Art here in Los Angeles, and it was when John Baldessari was still alive, which was awesome. So I got to interview him, and they were doing a special presentation, and they were going to show it. They showed it at the museum. So I kind of wanted to do just like a nice film about him and talk to people that knew him and kind of film it in a style that kind of felt kind of John Baldessari, and just kind of do like a film that gave people an understanding of who he was and his importance in the world, in the art world.
Absolutely, Tamra Davis, through this piece of art, you showed the importance of that artist. And I picked one of my favorite sentences of It's a John Baldessari words, which is, what's green and goes up and down? A pea in an elevator.
I know. Yeah, that's one of John Baldessari's his work. And I love that he had humor in his artwork. So I think it's really fun to show that there sometimes art can be funny. And he was such a funny guy. So I liked featuring that aspect of him.
You loved featuring that aspect in this documentary, and that format is a format that you are enjoying a lot. Can you tell us a little bit more about what led you to direct documentaries?
I mean, I feel like from the beginning when I was doing just trying to establish myself as a filmmaker, documentaries are ways to tell short films and kind of, I don't know, I think one of my very first films was a film called Vida Loca, and not to get confused with Allison Anders' movie, but yeah, I made a documentary called Vida Loca, and it was about gangs in California, in Southern California. And so I felt like it was easy. It was a kind of a format where you could film somebody, interview them, film kind of B-roll and put it together into a movie. And yeah, I felt like it was I really liked that format, and I continued, and I've made a couple of documentaries since then. But yeah, no, I think it's a really cool format, and I love documentaries, and it's especially easy if you're trying to become like a new filmmaker. It's a little bit easier to finance or put something like that together.
It is a little bit easier, as you just mentioned, Tamra Davis, to finance it. And on one side, there is this part of documentary that is, as I mentioned, unfiltered and very natural. But on the other hand, It can also give you a lot of space for creativity. For example, in your documentary called Jean-Michel Basquiat, The Radiant Child, when you're starting this piece of art with the sound of a wall-muraled old projector. This is a very special sound element.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I know, I don't know even know. I think that came from, yeah, I don't know why I used that, but I did like that sound. And I started with a quote from, I believe it's a Langston Hughes quote. I think it's a quote from somebody about, being a genius. I forget the exact quote, but it kind of summed up Jean-Michel and how misunderstood he was. But yeah, no, that was a different kind of documentary, especially on that one. I had made the footage and filmed it while Jean-Michel was alive, and he'd asked me to make a documentary about him. And so we filmed a lot, and we filmed interview portions, and then also filmed him painting and things like that. And then, but then when he died, I took the footage and I kind of put it in a closet because he was very particular. He kind of really felt that a lot of his friends took advantage of him and, you know, like sold paintings that he gave him or just like tried to take advantage of their association with him. So I was like, oh my God, even dead, I didn't want Jean-Michel to think I was taking advantage of him. And so I didn't do anything with the footage. And then I guess like 20 years later, I talked to a woman and they were doing a retrospective of his work. And I mentioned that I had this footage and she was just shocked. And she said, you know, there's very little footage of him. Like, this is really, you can't just leave it in your closet. You have to do something with it. You have to let people see this footage. And so I brought it out and I made a film out of it. And, and I realized that it was important actually for Jean-Michel to get a chance for him to speak and to really make a film that I think he would have been happy to have, you know, the words told about him in this way.
Absolutely. Tamra Davis, as you just mentioned, a long time after recording those images, you took the film out of the closet. And I am wondering if you were surprised about what you previously recorded, because the gap between those two moments, the gap was very long.
It was, but in all honesty, it feels like it was this, it felt so familiar and like yesterday because, you know, I was listening to a friend. Yeah. It was like a conversation with a friend. And so, you know, whenever you go put yourself back there, you kind of feel like that moment, I don't know, it didn't seem like so far away. And also the footage, I don't know, it didn't seem like it was that long ago, you know, I don't know. I think that, you know, and then I filmed a lot of contemporary stuff, but I also thought it was really important to get people to understand what that world was like back in New York in those early 80s and the creativity in downtown New York and that scene, which is where he came from. And so I think that having all the archival from that time and the music and I thought that was really important to kind of building the world so you could see where he came from.
Furthermore, Tamra Davis, through this documentary called Jean-Michel Basquiat, The Radiant Child, we can completely emerge ourselves into that New York that you just described. And I truly feel that it feels like this is both a tribute to Basquiat geniuses, but also a cautionary tale about the perils of fame, and especially in the art industry. Would you say that you are seeing this documentary with this vision? And what are, for example, the purposes that you had at the beginning?
I guess I wanted to tell his story the way I thought that he would have wanted it to be told. And it was a very sad story. I mean, he died at 27 years old. So it kind of was a tragedy, even though he got the fame he wanted and was the painter that he told everybody he was. And now, of course, as you know, his paintings go for, I don't even know what his last painting sold for, over $100 million. But, you know, so I feel like he sacrificed himself in a way, because he was that, you know, he didn't really know that he was that important when he died. He kind of thought that his life was over. And yeah, I definitely saw it as a cautionary tale because he really listened to the critics and what people said about him. And he also had a drug problem that I didn't really want to focus too much on, but it just got exasperated because he, you know, dealing with the fame and the stress and, you know, whatever, I think that that was really hard on him. And I think it's hard on anybody. And this is even before social media. So, you know, I think that we as a society need to be careful in our criticism towards artists and musicians and talent. And I don't know, it's you have to be careful because people are very sensitive and artists are sensitive. I don't know, it makes me think of like how Frank Ocean just played Coachella and he did an amazing set and it was experimental, but people criticized it and then he didn't play the next night. And it's like, you can't, like Frank Ocean is a beautiful, gentle art, like he's an artist. You can't just like think that he's gonna go and please you. And so I don't know, I just feel like we have to be really careful as critics of what we think we need to tell everybody about our personal tastes.
We have to be careful, Tamra Davis, about the critics that we are giving. And you didn't had social media. Social media didn't existed during that time. And in this world of making documentary, gaining the trust of your subject is something very crucial and very important. How did you go about building those links and those relation of trust between all of the subjects that you exchanged with, but also with Jean-Michel Basquiat?
I mean, with Jean-Michel specifically, he was a friend. And I mean, that relationship was built over years of just hanging out all the time. So when we talk, we can talk and have fun and play, and you can kind of feel that in the interview. And so I feel like that's part of like having like being interviewed by somebody you know. So that's really important. But the other people that I interviewed for the film, a lot of them I knew already. But I think like if you, as a filmmaker or a documentary filmmaker, I think that it's important to just be open and go into a situation and listen and try to see, put the person at ease and just kind of be a good listener and try to make sure the person feels heard and understood. So I think like that's kind of what you try to do when you go in and just listen to people. There's some people that are really great interviewers. I've been really listening to Rick Rubin's podcast lately, and I think he's a really good interviewer.
Absolutely, Tamra Davis. Being open and listening deeply to all of your subject and the people you are talking to. And to come back to the title of that documentary, if I understood correctly, it was actually inspired from an essay from the author René Ricard called The Radiant Child. And I truly believe that this book may have a huge influence on the making of that documentary. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Well, I did interview René Ricard, and I do remember that article. You're right. He did call him a radiant child. But I wasn't that influenced by René Ricard. I know a lot of people love René Ricard. He was an art critic for New York. But yeah, I wasn't as influenced by that as I was actually influenced by Jean-Michel. I kind of had his words to guide me and then his artwork. And I kind of really looked at all his paintings and his, the, what he was trying to say through his art and let that kind of guide me. And I kind of had an understanding of who he was and what his influences were. And he also kind of gave me a list of people that he wanted me to interview back in the day and just, yeah, people that I knew that could speak well of him. So it was more, I feel like that. I guess I wasn't, other than taking the title, I wasn't as influenced by that article, although I thought it was really important for Jean-Michel's, and it was actually the article that put him on the map. He was the first person to really recognize Jean-Michel and, you know, talk about his work in a very serious way, kind of like brought him on the scene and was credited for that.
Absolutely, Tamra Davis, that article put it, Jean-Michel Basquiat in the map. And you actually ended the documentary with the song, Free Him and Let His Soul Run Wild, because you have a very special relationship with music and also in this city of New York City, for example, filming the opening scene of 13, the musical, on the Pulitzer Fountain. And I would love to discuss about this project and especially those first minutes.
Thank you. I loved making that film. And yeah, the opening number takes place in New York City. And so the film was originally shot in Canada, so I really fought hard to make sure I got to shoot the opening in New York. So finally, we were able to do it. And it went from like, oh, you have 5 days to shoot in New York, to like, you have 3 days to shoot in New York, to like, you have, literally, they said I had 1 day to shoot in New York. And I had to get at least 2 days because I was dealing with children, and you can only shoot with children a certain amount of hours. All those kids are under 15. They're between 12, 11 and 15. And so I only had like a certain amount of hours. And what's really interesting about that opening sequence is it's with all within one block, because I didn't have a lot of time, I couldn't move that entire company of crew and trucks and cast and everything. So I knew I was going to shoot the front of the plaza, and the Pulitzer Fountain is across the street from that. And the park is across the street from that. And the stair, you know, all those areas, the street and everything is within one block. And so for me as a director, it allowed me to literally, like, we didn't have police to stop cars as we crossed the street. We just went. The path that we did was literally the path of where those buildings and everything line up on a corner in New York. And that was the only way I could make my day, is to basically walk everybody to those locations. Like coming down the hill in that park, it's literally walking distance. Everything is less than a block. So that's kind of the genius of trying to pull something like that off. You can't move a company in the middle of New York City in a day. So I had to do it all in one place.
You cannot move an entire team and company all around New York City in one day, Tamra Davis. And there are multiple places, as you just mentioned. We have the Pulitzer Fountain facing the Apple Fifth Avenue, also the Palace entrance, but also Central Park, and I completely recognized all of those venues, and it adds a lot of color to the feature film, and it also make a huge impression.
Great. I know, I loved it. I thought, yeah, the production value you get out of New York City is insane. And so I just was like, please just give me, I could do it in a few hours, but you got to let me shoot there. So I was so happy that they let me do it. Yeah. I mean, you can move a crew in a day in New York. You just lose time. Anytime you move your crew, you're now that's an hour gone. And like I said, when you're dealing with children, like they can only work a certain amount of time and then they have to take breaks. And it's really, it's very complicated. So you really have to be very planned, very strategic.
You always have, Tamra Davis, to be very strategic. And I would love to know more about this very specific storyline. How would you describe the story of this 12-year-old kid navigating a very special period of his life related to the bar mitzvah and also dealing with his parents?
I was so excited to get this job. It came to me, it was Netflix, and it was a play originally on Broadway called 13, the musical. And so I worked with the composer and to turn it into a film version. And the beginning of it takes place in New York City. It's about a boy whose parents get a divorce and he's got to move with his mother to a small town in the middle of nowhere. And he's supposed to have his bar mitzvah, which is the biggest party that you're supposed to have. And all your friends are supposed to be there. But he's moving to a new small town and he doesn't know anybody. And he thinks that if this party is like awful, like it's just he'll never live it, you know, it'll just be a tragedy in his life. And so he really wants to come to the new town and have a party and kind of make it special. But in doing so, he ends up getting into quite a bit of trouble as he tries to get people to like him. And so it's just kind of what happens when you do things. And I don't know. I really liked working, you know, in that moment where you realize as a teenager, you try risky behavior and sometimes it doesn't work out and you mess up and it's like the worst thing happens. And then you have to figure out how do you survive that moment? How do you say sorry? How do you come back and not be known as the person who did the wrong thing the whole time? And I think that was something that I really wanted to talk about is that everybody kind of messes up and it's really about how you respond to that and how you, face that you did something wrong and you ask for forgiveness and you come back again. And I think it was a really important thing to kind of teach that forgiveness and that, ability to kind of move past those moments in your life that you think are so devastating. But you can come back from them and kind of make yourself into a better person from those tribulations. And I also just really loved working on the film because, like I said, it's a musical and I got to work with beautifully talented young people on these gorgeous, like great dance numbers. And it just was so fun. Every time I watched them, it just made me so happy to see this talent. And it was really a fun film to make.
In definitive, Tamra Davis, this experience of directing that feature film called 13 the Musical was a perfect match because it embodied your actual knowledge of capturing the essence of a song because you directed a lot of music video, but all of this knowledge came from one address, which is the 855 North Vermont Avenue, which is the precise location of the Los Angeles City College. Can you tell us a little bit more about those beginnings as a director?
So I went to LA City College. It's in Los Angeles. It's on Vermont and Melrose. And it's a city college where you only, like when I was there, you paid $50 for tuition per semester. And I went through the film program and they had just built the building. So it was a really beautiful state of the art facility and they had all new film equipment. And I found it to be really helpful. It put me in a situation where I was making films and I showed them to students, and you, they got to review them, and you could, and I think that really, if you want to be a filmmaker, it's so important to make a film, finish it, and show it. Until you're really doing those steps and you actually show your movie, which means it has to be done enough to show it and screen it, you know, you're not really a filmmaker. But in the same thing is like, if you make a movie and you show it, you're a filmmaker. So it works both ways. And I think that going to film school, you get assignments. And so you really have to finish those assignments and show them. And you can kind of see how your work compares with other students. And you can see, oh, I'm talent, you know, I have an ability to get a message across, or people seem to like my film. So I think in that sense, it gave me confidence that the stuff I was doing, I was definitely making things that people really liked, and I really enjoyed making them myself. So I really enjoyed the school experience, and I had a pretty unique, I don't know, I liked the school that I went to. I thought that they had a good program there, and it wasn't that expensive. So by the time I got out of it, I wasn't in like a ton of student debt or anything. And I had like, I had like some cool short films to show. Some of the other schools, they don't let you, only maybe you make one film, or you work on everybody else's, and then you don't even own that film. They own it. Or, you know, this spends tens of thousands of dollars to go there. And I thought, wow, I could spend that tens of thousands of dollars on making movies. So, yeah, so in that case, I really loved the school program. But what happened to me is when I got out of film school, I thought, wow, I can make a movie now. I'm so, you know, I'm really good. I'm ready to make my first feature. And I had a script, and I had a videotape of the bands that I wanted on the soundtrack. And so I went into a movie company and presented my script and my vision for the film, and here's the bands on the soundtrack. And basically I was kind of like laughed at, like nobody was looking for a 23-year-old girl out of film school in the late 80s to direct. Like it was unheard of. And yes, they were definitely hiring guys out of film school. Like it was kind of like a rite of passage. You'd be like, yeah, I just hired this dude from USC or this guy from UCLA. But no, like it was kind of sad. There was no room for a young girl coming out of film school at that time. But luckily, or whatever, I had on that videotape, I made a video of a band that I wanted to be on my soundtrack, and I filmed it with like a Super 8 camera. And I got a call from the record company that the band was on, and I was like, oh my God, now I'm in trouble. I didn't even get permission from that band, and I had to go in to talk to the record company and see like what kind of trouble I was in, because I didn't ask for approval. I just used the song and I made a video. And instead, when I met with the head of their creative department, they said, how did you do this? And I said, I shot it myself in Super 8. And they were like, this is brilliant. We want to give you all this money to direct a video for some other band if you can make them look like this. And so then, like overnight, I was a music video director, and I started getting all these jobs from all these different record companies, and I became incredibly successful as a music video director. And that was, yeah, it was kind of by not mistake, but it was like I was on my road to one thing, and I pivoted, thankfully, to a new genre and a new medium that was developing, which was music videos. And I had a style that was unique and interesting. And it was at a time when MTV, everything looked like really slick and clean. And I came in with like this kind of edgy, cool, black and white, grainy look. And I just started working. And it took probably like 6 or 7 years of me making music videos before I could convince somebody that I was capable of doing a feature, which is sad. But in one sense, I kind of felt like in those years, I really worked hard and I figured out what I became a director. And maybe I wouldn't have made such a good movie if I made that first film coming out of film school at 24. And by this time at 29, I really knew, I felt really confident, and I really knew what to do. And I knew how to work with actors. I knew how to work with how to move, you know, cameras around in a day and what I could do in a day. And so I feel like it kind of worked out to be the best that I I got all that experience from film school, from doing all these music videos, and I made short films in the meantime. Like, I would save my money for music videos and make little short narratives and put them into film festivals and kind of try to get myself known. But yeah, basically, I felt like finally I was able to get somebody to make a movie. And I agreed to make a movie originally for $400,000. That's how much I thought I could do Gun Crazy for, because that's how much they said they had for the budget. And then I was lucky when I signed Drew Barrymore on the film, we were able to sell like another country, or actually it was Michael Ironside. When Michael Ironside signed up, I was able to sell my Asian markets and I got another $400,000. So I was able to make the film for $800,000. Yeah. So it was, and I did it. Yeah, I did it. I think I shot it in 23 days. Yeah. And I'm really proud of that film.
You are very proud of that film, Tamra Davis, because it worked out for the best. And you just mentioned one very powerful word, which is bend, because you are currently working on a project called Boys Band that is retracing the history of a historical musical band, with the Beatles, NSYNC, the Backstreet Boys, New Kids on the Block, the Jackson 5, the Beatles, New Edition, One Direction, and BTS.
Yes, I am. That's true. Yes, I'm doing, I got, during this, there's been a strike on, so normally I'd be working on a TV show or a film, but we haven't been able to work. So I got a call from Paramount Plus that they wanted to make a movie about boy bands, and the producers are actually the people who called me, Van Toffler and Johnny Wright. And Van Toffler, he used to run MTV, and I knew him for decades. I've known Van. And then Johnny Wright, I knew because he's a manager for NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, and I met him during when I worked with Britney. And so those guys kind of knew me from my days of doing music videos, and I'd done some boy band videos, and they asked if I would be interested in directing this. And I was like, yes, this is perfect. I love these bands, and it's a fun thing to work on now while, you know, we're still pretty shut down. The actors are still on strike. I think the writers just made a deal. So I'm psyched that things are going to start moving again. But yeah, so it's super fun to be making a documentary. It's a three-part series. It's going to be announced probably in the next couple days. I think on the 27th or something, they'll announce it officially. But yeah, I go from Beatles to BTS is kind of my span. So yeah, going from the Beatles were the first time the term boy band was coined. And currently the biggest boy band or biggest band in the world right now is BTS. And so I'm going to feature them as well.
I am looking forward to see that documentary directed by yourself and produced by Johnny Wright and Von Toffler. Thank you very much, Tamra Davis.
Yeah, I'm excited too. Yeah, those guys are awesome and I love working with them. Yeah, and Paramount Plus is cool because it's not like I have free access to their library, but they own, you know, they own the MTV, you know, all those libraries. So there's so much in there because they, you know, had TRL and all that. So it's going to be really fun to kind of be able to dig back in. And it's so fun doing research today. I went down a deep hole into the female K-pop bands and was like watched a ton of Blackpink today. And so it was so fun to be watching these videos and be like, I can't believe I'm working and I'm watching Carpool Karaoke with Blackpink or watching all their videos and I'm working. So I really enjoyed it.